The next case on our calendar is 05-1213, Disciplinary Council versus Aaron Phillips. Mr. Merman.
Morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court, I'm here today. I'm Michael Merman on behalf of Aaron Phillips, asking the court to modify the report and recommendation of the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline. I'm here to ask you to adopt the dissenting opinion in that recommendation, more specifically to allow Aaron Phillips an indefinite suspension and the opportunity someday in the future to be able to prove himself to the board and to this court as a person entitled to call himself an attorney at law. I indicated three specific areas that I'd ask you to concentrate on, and I suppose probably in the order of most importance, I believe that we demonstrated by clear and convincing evidence in this case that Aaron has demonstrated those measures of mitigation that ought to give him a chance. We're not asking that he be reinstated, of course, today, but this is a young man who is certainly guilty of serious misconduct. He pled guilty to it, admitted it, and stipulated to it in the proceedings before the board. However, it's undisputed that this misconduct was, to some extent, the product of addiction, of chemical dependency. And although the majority opinion from the board suggests that knowledge that one has a propensity for alcoholism or drug abuse somehow vitiates or eliminates this as a mitigation, I don't believe that is the rule that the court has adopted. I don't believe that's consistent with the cases in which mitigation has been demonstrated to this court. And I believe Aaron has demonstrated over a period of years a genuine and sincere commitment to rehabilitation and to treatment. Even the prosecutor indicated in his presentation to the court at sentencing that this all arose out of Aaron's descent into the world of drugs and the people that used them, that he was living a double life at the time, that he was a brilliant prosecutor and very effective on behalf of the state of Ohio in Cuyahoga County. And then in his second life, in his secret life, in the evenings, away from the court, he was abusing drugs. He was hanging out with a underworld element, and he got himself into a lifestyle that he didn't seem to believe that there were any limits on him. However, once he sobered up and went through treatment, he did recognize how serious these matters were. He's indicated genuine remorse. He's a relatively young man, and he meets all the criteria for receiving some mitigation for the chemical dependency and the subsequent treatment. He has otherwise been a solid member of the community and a person of good character. He went through a period of time that was an aberration in his life, and we would ask that that period not be cause for professional capital punishment, which is what we call the permanent disbarment that we have in Ohio, which is relatively rare in the United States today. And I'm not criticizing that we have it. It is appropriate in some circumstances, but I believe it should be reserved for those people who have demonstrated an indifference to their professional responsibilities, those people who are unwilling to accept that they have been involved in serious misconduct, who have demonstrated an inability to accept or understand how serious their conduct is.
Can you compare this case with the Colombo case, another prosecutor from Cleveland for the court, and maybe draw some analogies for us in terms of punishment?
Certainly, Justice O'Donnell. James Colombo was also an assistant county prosecutor in the same county prosecutor's office as Aaron Phillips. James was actually a higher official in the hierarchy. He was in charge of the drug prosecution unit at the time of his fall and was doing a fantastic job by all accounts in handling the major drug prosecutions for Cuyahoga County. Aaron was in the major trial division. These would be the more skilled prosecutors who handled big cases, but he was not a supervisor or in charge of a unit. Jim, at some point, decided to taste the evidence. And once he tasted the forbidden fruit, I guess he liked it, because he then had the police bring over evidence from time to time, presumably to check on it, make sure that they had the size and the weight and the things that they were supposed to have for trial, and then he'd take a bit for himself and became addicted to cocaine. Eventually was caught. When he was caught, similar to Aaron, he recognized that he was caught. He recognized how serious these matters were. He obtained counsel. He pled guilty. He cooperated with the police. He went to prison. All of these things are in common with Aaron. Aaron had the same experience. In fact, you might say that he followed the James Colombo example upon being caught of what a lawyer ought to do to try to save himself. I'm not saying that that happened. He didn't have counsel at that time, but he certainly followed the pattern that James Colombo had. Similarly, he stipulated or admitted to all of these things in the discipline case, and the difference is that he was ultimately given indefinite suspension, although there is a similarity that they sought disbarment. In fact, a minority of the court felt that the offense was so serious when committed by an assistant county prosecutor that there was no other penalty but permanent disbarment. Fortunately for Mr. Colombo, the majority prevailed in 4-3. They gave him an indefinite suspension. Now, we can fast forward with James because he's still out there and practicing law. Some 3 or 4 years later, he was back before the court with an application to be readmitted. And by that time, he had a period of several years in which he demonstrated an absolute commitment to rehabilitation and to living a drug-free life, to contributing back to the community. And today, he's a practicing lawyer in Cuyahoga County. He's not a prosecutor, of course, but he's working with lawyers and judges and others who've had issues with chemical dependency throughout the state. He serves as an expert witness in that area. He lectures regularly on the subject. And I maintain, on behalf of Aaron, that Aaron ought to be given that same opportunity that James Colombo was given, that there's not a difference between this case and that case, except that in James' case, we didn't have a rule of court that actually set forth the criteria for the chemical dependency rehabilitation mitigation. We do today. And in fact, the criteria we have looks like it was modeled after what happened in the James Colombo case. My guess is that his counsel was aware of the ABA standards on that and advised him and counseled him to follow those standards, and that all happened before this court adopted a similar mitigation in the state of Ohio. But I think that case and the other case that I think is significant here, since the board and the disciplinary counsel has made such an issue over the fact that he's a public official or was a public official and breached that trust, is the Johnson case, which I've cited in my brief. There we had a state senator. There's no chemical dependency issue, but we have a state senator who was taking bribes, also a very, very serious offense. Yet nonetheless, the court concluded that the door ought to be left open a crack. I don't know that Mr. Johnson has been reinstated. If so, I'm not aware of it. But the door was open, left open a crack, so that in a future time, this young person would be allowed the opportunity to present and have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he has the character and fitness to once again become an attorney at law.
Counsel, are you taking the position that there should never be permanent disbarment when there is a substance abuse problem?
No, Justice Lansinger, I'm not. I wouldn't go that far. because I think that there are substance abuse problems. But even the court's criteria is that that's not enough. That's not mitigation enough in my opinion. I think, though, where there is a connection between the substance abuse and the criminal conduct, and there's a diagnosis from a qualified healthcare professional, and there is the course of treatment and rehabilitation that's over a substantial period of time before this court actually gets the case, that there ought to be a presumption against disbarment. Not necessarily that disbarment could never occur, because there could be other things, such as a history of misconduct or some evidence that a history of discipline, I'm suggesting. There may certainly be circumstances where disbarment might still be the appropriate sanction to protect the public, but I don't think we have it here.
So you don't think that the seriousness of conduct of a prosecutor attempting to obtain bribes in his capacity as a prosecutor, a serious misconduct, in your view, would never trump those conditions that you just outlined?
The misconduct, never is a really strong word, Justice Lanziger, and I'm not sure I could say never because I don't know what all the circumstances might be, and there might be a case where it ought to trump everything. And I know we've had cases with judges, one judge in particular from Cuyahoga County who had demonstrated a commitment to rehabilitation and drug treatment and so forth, and the court concluded that for a judge it wasn't available. I don't think we want to adopt such a rule for an assistant county prosecutor any more than we would for a state senator. So I guess, each case does rise and fall on its facts. And so I would not ever say that, I would never say never, if it pleased the court. And I'd like to save the last 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Merman. Ms. Brown.
Good morning. May it please the court, Lori Brown on behalf of Relator Disciplinary Counsel. Relator's position is exactly pursuant to the question just asked by Justice Lanziger, that this misconduct is so serious by an assistant Cuyahoga County prosecutor that no amount of mitigation saves Mr. Phillips' license, if you will. This is a case in which there was substantial and significant mitigation. Mr. Phillips entered drug treatment and has rehabilitated himself to the extent that he is no longer addicted to drugs and alcohol. However, given the fact that Mr. Phillips gained access to the individuals that he attempted to bribe and in one case did in fact bribe him, in fact three cases there were individuals who actually paid him money, he gained access to those individuals because he was an assistant Cuyahoga County prosecutor. With regard to Mr. Merman's statements about the Colombo case, first of all, I need to clarify one particular statement made by Mr. Merman. There's a footnote in the Colombo decision that indicates that Mr. Colombo was in charge of the rape and murder unit of the prosecutor's office. He was not in charge of drug cases. He also, prior to becoming addicted to cocaine, was an alcoholic. He developed liver problems. He was in significant pain as a result of continuing to drink. He then decided that what he was going to do was literally steal cocaine from the evidence room. Mr. Colombo's misconduct was personal misconduct. It involved his position as an assistant county prosecutor that gave him access to the drugs. It did not involve anyone else. Mr. Colombo was convicted of crimes involving himself only. Mr. Phillips went out into the community, if you will, of criminal defendants, gained access to those defendants, and preyed on them, if you will, in their weaknesses. They were seeking any advantage they could get, as Judge Satula said at the sentencing hearing. Those criminal defendants were seeking any advantage that they could find to give them one up, if you will, on the criminal justice system in their criminal cases before the Cuyahoga County courts. This is simply a case where the misconduct is so significant that no amount of mitigation, quality mitigation, substantial mitigation, as we have mentioned, but no amount of mitigation can justify any sanction less than permanent disbarment in this case.
Did his use of drugs begin when the conduct, the egregious conduct, began? In other words, he was not addicted to drugs before he began to violate his oath as a lawyer?
Mr. Phillips was admitted to the practice of law in Ohio in 1994. He became an assistant county prosecutor in 1996. The record indicates that he began using cocaine in either 1999 or 2000. The criminal conduct in this case, the evidence indicates it began in approximately 2001. So there is some period of time, perhaps 10 or 11 months, between his... He originally started drinking. He switched then to using marijuana. He switched then to using cocaine from marijuana. And I believe there's some continuation of the alcohol and marijuana use as well as the cocaine use. So there is some small period, relatively narrow window of time when he was using drugs and alcohol and not engaging in the criminal conduct. With regard to the Jeffrey Johnson case, also mentioned in Mr. Merman's argument to this court, Mr. Johnson, yes, was a state official. He was charged with violations of three of the personal misconduct sections, 1102A4, A5, and A6. Mr. Phillips was also charged with violating 8101A3 and 9101C, taking action as a public official and accepting money with the indication that he could influence a public official. His conduct, I would submit, is more similar to that of Daniel O'Brien in the Dayton Bar Association case versus Daniel O'Brien. That is the case in which the attorney, Mr. O'Brien, indicated to a client that if the client could somehow come up with $12,000, somebody might owe the judge a favor, and the judge would allow the client to withdraw his guilty plea and thereby go to trial. The fact that Mr. O'Brien never obtained the money, never paid the money to anyone to influence the judge, made no difference to this court. Mr. O'Brien, for that one particular instance with one client, was indefinitely suspended. We have very similar conduct on the part of Mr. Phillips with regard to five individuals in this case. A total of 12 felonies. Mr. Phillips was convicted of 12 felonies. 1F3, the bribery count, the top count, if you will, of the indictment. 5 counts of attempted bribery. 2 counts of attempted obstruction of justice. 1 count of possession of drugs, 1 count of possession of criminal tools, 1 count of attempted tampering with evidence. And that also, referring again to the sentencing hearing, most disturbed Judge Satula, because when he was released from jail, Mr. Phillips went back to his office and attempted to destroy evidence that could have been used to convict him of the crimes. It is for all of those reasons that this case can be distinguished from James Colombo, from James Cornell Young, from Jeffrey Johnson. It can be distinguished also from the case of Daniel O'Brien, because this is a case involving 5 different individuals and 5 different chances for Mr. Phillips to imply to those individuals that he could or would influence the court.
Counsel, what was the possession of criminal tools?
There were drug scales. The drugs, the amount was found in his car along with a scale. So he was charged with possession of criminal tools because of those drug implements.
Implication could be that he was dealing, or is it just...
There's nothing to indicate that in the record, Your Honor.
That's there to make sure he's getting full value for his purchase.
I don't know that either, Your Honor.
The reason I asked the question is I thought maybe it was burglary tools or something where there was a threat or potential danger to others.
No, my understanding of the indication in the record from the prosecution of Mr. Phillips is that it was a drug scale and drug paraphernalia.
Senator Johnson did not allege any alcohol or drug dependency, as I recall.
There's nothing in the record, Your Honor.
So he was taking money to supposedly, instead of fixing cases, fix the outcome of matters with the state over whom he should presumably have some influence.
That's correct.
Is that different? Is that a lower standard than someone who implies that they can somehow fix a case with a judge?
It's different. I would agree with you there. Is it lower or higher? I don't know that it is one or the other. It is definitely different. And you are correct in that Mr. Johnson's conduct was similar because he had access to those individuals because of his position. That's absolutely correct.
Is it correct here that no cases were actually fixed?
Yes, it is correct. I will go one step further with regard to your question about Mr. Johnson. In the O'Brien case, this court was particularly sensitive to the fact that a lawyer implied to a criminal defendant that he could somehow influence a judge. And that is what happened in this case time and time again. And that is why the misconduct and the criminal conduct.
So you suggest that perhaps it is different?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I do. Yes. For all of the reasons set forth in Relator's brief and for the reasons I've stated here this morning, Relator believes that Aaron Phillips should be permanently disbarred.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Mr. Merman, you've saved just about 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you. Obviously, Ms. Brown and I disagree on this. I don't believe that these facts make it mandatory or would make it inconsistent for the court to grant an indefinite suspension in this case. I do think that a state senator taking bribes to influence the outcomes in Columbus, it seems to me that that's at least as high of an official and as an egregious a matter as an assistant county prosecutor in Cuyahoga County dealing with these criminal defendants. I'm not suggesting that either one of them is forgivable.
His status is somewhat different. He's actually elected, which presumably would give him a higher status.
There should be a higher standard of conduct even.
Right.
But they're both very important positions. The conduct is very serious. I don't have any question about that. I'm not here to argue that or to minimize the misconduct. But I do believe that the court has found in the past a basis for even where there's serious misconduct by a public official, when there's some substantial evidence of remorse, of mitigation, to leave that door open a crack for the possibility that they can come back in the future and convince you to allow them to practice law again. There's only a certain range of sanctions that are available to the court. And the only one that requires an application and a proof of character and fitness is the indefinite suspension. And so we have some cases where the conduct doesn't seem nearly as serious as some other cases that all have to be into that category of indefinite suspension, because if you don't do that, if you just give a time suspension, the time's over, they reapply, they're reinstated. The court and the system doesn't get a second chance to look at it before making the decision. The indefinite suspension requires that the applicant come in after a requisite period of time, which could be 2 years from this court's decision, which would make it 4 or 5 years from when the misconduct occurred. That's the earliest that they can come back. They have to apply, and they have to submit to character and fitness, which means their whole life is an open book again, and they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they, at that point in time, are fit to be a lawyer. And that's all we're asking, is that possibility be left open out there, that I don't believe the facts in this case are so egregious that door ought to be completely shut.
The prosecutor who was helping himself to the cocaine from the evidence room, he never got involved in any case-fixing propositions, did he?
No, he didn't. And I don't remember the footnote in the case that Ms. Brown talks about, but I remember the facts in the case. And one of the things that made it so serious is that this did alter the weights, and he was substituting things in so that the bags had, didn't look like they were altered. He was the head of the drug unit. I was there. I don't know what the footnote says, but yeah. The facts in the case certainly don't indicate that he had anything to do with murder and rape.
What did we do with we had another couple of lawyers who were running, and maybe that's just not close enough up there, who were running, laundering drug money. FBI sting caught them. Did we laundering drug money? You don't recall? It's not exactly the same, but it.
I'm not real sure. I know we have had some serious misconduct by lawyers, and not prosecutors.
Yeah, they were. I think they were not prosecutors. They were caught up in the.
And I think in
the sting.
Some of those cases, there wasn't much in the way of mitigation, and they didn't put on much of a defense. I know in a couple of them, I think it's maybe Sanford Atkins, it was like a default. He didn't even defend himself, and he was disbarred. Now, he's the one that said he could bribe Federal Judge White.
Yeah.
But this is not that case. This is a man who did do all the right things after he was caught. Obviously, it would have been better if he would have done the right things before he was caught. Maybe he wouldn't be here today.
Counsel, how bad would this case have gotten, had to have gotten, before a disbarment would be appropriate in your mind? He started out in the prosecutor's office, found out that he really couldn't handle his liquor when he went out drinking, so he had to do something that wasn't going to give him a hangover, so he decides marijuana, but you can detect that too easily on your clothing. So he figures that, well, I'll try cocaine. And then his habit grew to the $350 a day or something similar to that. So he decides that his source of dollars are going to be the defendants that he's sworn to prosecute. Okay. What in your mind would warrant a disbarment? Not doing the right thing when he's caught?
I think the facts without mitigation would certainly warrant disbarment, just as they are. I think if the facts were as they are, including the conduct that has occurred since he was caught, that I think is strong mitigation, and he were a senior person, he was my age, with my experience, and in the law, you'd have to say, well, you know, there's no hope, it's too late. But with a young man such as Aaron Phillips, with a relatively short experience as a lawyer, terrible misconduct, but then doing all the right things afterward and showing a genuine commitment to reform and to rehabilitation, I think that you are not required to disbar him. Certainly you have the power to do it, and you can find precedent that will support it. I'm here to suggest that you don't have to, and that he and other young people like him will be encouraged by giving him the opportunity. I also indicate that it's to take away this young lawyer from the community on this case is a tragedy, and that ought to be considered. I know I've gone over my time, and I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Merman. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.